Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. As Kathy mentioned, I'm Jennifer Schatz, Senior Vice President of Marketing for Matthews International Capital Management here in San Francisco. Tonight's program, Investing in India Today, is part of the member-led platform series called India Now. We'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, Wells Fargo and Ernst & Young, for their generous support. Presenting this evening is my colleague at Matthews, Sunil Asnani, who is the co-manager of Matthews India Strategy. Before joining Matthews in 2008, Sunil was an analyst with McKinsey & Company in New York. He's a native of Rajasthan in western India and received a Bachelor of Technology degree from the Indian Institute of Technology in Delhi. Sunil earned his MBA at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And from 1999 to 2004, he held a variety of roles, but the one that gets the most attention and interest is that Sunil was the superintendent of police in the state of Kerala in southern India. So with that, I'd like to welcome Sunil to the stage, and he'll tell you more about investing in India today.
I hope I didn't scare you. People get scared when they hear of police in India. I hope police in the U.S. is much better. So before I start with my monologue, I would like to learn more about my audience. When is the last time anybody visited India? I mean, did anybody visit India at all? Yeah, that counts. That counts. And do you guys visit India very frequently or? Okay. But not like 3 times a year. Okay. Cool. How many of you actually have invested in India directly or indirectly in any capacity? Okay, cool. So before I start with speaking about India, I would like to touch some misconceptions about India, because what we know about India is mostly through media, and we don't have the luxury of traveling to India 3 times a year, and neither have grew up in India. I grew up in India, but I don't expect everybody to be doing so. So I would like to clarify certain misconceptions. What happens is media projects news which creates, sensations. I mean, I'm not blaming media, but that's what sells. And sometimes they don't show the other side of the picture. So I will try to present a balanced picture about India. It's commonly believed that India is a services-oriented economy, and it's rightly so. But what people, as a consequence, tend to believe is that India lacks manufacturing capabilities. And services has been a big contributor to India's growth. In fact, 2/3 of our economy is through services. But manufacturing is also important. In fact, if you look at the healthcare industry, India has the largest number of U.S. FDA-approved generic drugs manufacturing plants. And you might wonder why it is ahead of China. China is the factory of the world, because Indians have, for right or wrong reasons, developed some chemistry skills over time, and we have a better record of protecting IP. So as a result, there is a niche where we have been able to create in manufacturing. And that's not all. If you look at the small cars, China is not the leader in manufacturing and exporting small cars all over the world. India is one of the leaders. So I have not lost hope on India's manufacturing capabilities. In fact, I think going forward, as China's competitiveness goes down, because their cost of labor is increasing, and India invests more in infrastructure, and they make reforms on labor and other areas, I think India will also become very competitive in manufacturing. So that's the first point. Second perception India have about people have about India is mostly a software economy. And I can see why people believe that. Most Indians I see in US, they have IT background. And my colleagues in business schools, they were mostly from IT background. So we tend to believe, oh, India means IT. But if you look at the statistics, only 5% of the economic output comes from software. And it employs much less than 1% of the total workforce. The other impression people have about India is that it's an emerging market. And when we hear emerging, we think, oh, it must be very illiquid market with very few securities and, you know, very not investable. But you'll be surprised to know that Bombay Stock Exchange was established in 1875, 2 years ahead of Tokyo Stock Exchange. And it has 5,000 listings, more than Tokyo Stock Exchange even now. In Asia Pacific, it's the most, it's the exchange with most listings. It doesn't mean that there are no issues with the exchange. I mean, the liquidity is not the best. There are still, the shorting is still not very frequent. But I just wanted to, you know, tell you the other side of the picture, that it is emerging but not so emerging as you might like to believe. The other misconceptions we have is that India is a very entrepreneurial place and the markets and the system support entrepreneurs. India is an entrepreneur place for sure. There is a culture of entrepreneurship, but it is not because of the system. It is actually in spite of the system. The Narayan Murthys of the world, Ambanis of the world, they struggle against the system to be where they are. And I would argue that if the systemic support increases, you will actually see more entrepreneurs, not less. So with that, I start with the brief the points I would like to highlight. First is the usual arguments that India is offering a growth in a slowing world, and what kind of growth is it? How is it different? And then I would like to touch a point where most people don't go. Most investors talk about growth, but they don't talk about the risks associated with that growth, and not all that grows is actually value creating. And then finally, I would like to discuss the time horizon people should have when investing in India. And my whatever little I've learned here demonstrates that you have to be patient. You can't time the market. I can't. If you can, then go ahead. So this is, if you look at this chart, this is telling you the economic growth in different periods of time. And for the last 2 decades, the growth has been, you know, upwards of 6 to 7%, and it has actually accelerated in the last few years. And I would argue that it has been because of some of the reforms which the government initiated in 1991. When I say reforms, it's not that they were giving any push for any industries. They just freed people, you know, to buy what they want, to sell what they want to sell. They just removed controls. That's all they did. And look at the kind of growth that India achieved simply by that. And going forward, I think if India is able to generate more investments in many of the assets like infrastructure, this growth can actually accelerate from this level. So that's the economic growth. And historically, we have grown fast, but we want to know whether it will sustain or continue in future also. So that's why I show this chart to people, whether India is a secular growth story. I mean, ask the audience, what do you think this family needs? By the way, this is a very common occurrence in India. Don't think that I am showing very selective pictures. It is not Adobe Photoshop. So what do you think this family needs? A car? Okay. What do you say? Home? Yeah, what else? Yeah, it's not very obvious, but yeah. Absolutely. That's correct. Very good. Yeah, you can, yeah, because this motorcycle was bought on cash, so I agree with you. Yes, that's true. They need it. They used to. In fact, the place where I used to work in Kerala, the biggest source of crime was accidents. Most crimes that occurred were actually accidents. People died of accidents more than any other violence. So, yeah, they need helmets. Yes, absolutely. I mean, and some... Sorry? And if you look at this lady who is wearing a dress, I bet she might, this might be one of her two or three dresses in a wardrobe. And these children, I mean, you think that they don't consume because they are not wearing much, but trust me, they consume a lot. And every year their dresses, you know, you need to... there is a limit to, you know, using each other's resources, but they need a lot. And the other point is, if you look at this gentleman, what do you think is going on in his head? What is at the top of his mind? What keeps him awake? It's how to provide for his family. And he's working day and night, you know, with that idea in mind. So on one side, he has the demand. Other side, he's thinking about working hard. He's probably a supplier to somebody else. So you have the demand and you have the worker to meet somebody else's demand. And when we talk about the compelling demographics of India, we talk about these children who are today their sources of demand, but tomorrow they are going to join the workforce in like 10 years. So that's why people say, oh, India has very compelling demographics. It will remain young for a long period to come. But this doesn't mean that everything that grows in India is good. We'll talk about that soon. Now, broadly speaking, we say that India's growth offers, you know, diversification. Yeah, at the economic growth level, I agree with that argument, and I will explain why. Most of the demand that you projected or forecasted for that family, I don't think they will be affected by what is happening in the United States. I mean, they are living on bare minimum resources, and I don't think they will care of whether there is a recession in the United States or not. They will continue to buy if they can. So that's the big if. But the demand, at least, is sustainable. All you need is to meet it. There may be some requirement of capital. For that, India is dependent on the world. But by and large, it has sustained its growth, and as you can see, on the chart on the right, this is in the middle of crisis when the whole world was like, you know, came to a standstill. India was growing by 6%, and India didn't do a lot of effort, didn't take a lot of effort to come back to the level it has now. India, in fact, gave some tax stimulus, much lesser than what China and other places, you know, did, and still it came out of the recession unscathed. So that speaks something about the resilience of the economy. There is an independent nature of the economy. And many other countries, you will see, they just sell commodities. The whole country is just selling one commodity. If the world stops buying, I mean, the whole economy comes to a standstill. This is not happening in India. So that's one part. And other part is, if you look at the components of GDP, like where does the... how does the economic output come from? Mostly it's from consumption. And consumption, what kind of consumption? Is the what people buy, you know. And as I demonstrated, that is very resilient, even in times of, you know, crisis elsewhere else. Now, many people ask me, you know, whether I should invest in India or I should invest in China. It comes very often. And China, it's a very, you know, different sources of GDP. Their consumption growth is there, but investment supersedes that. And a big part is also export-led. Almost 10% of their economic output comes from exports. So if there is a slowdown in the world, they get affected. If there is a loss of investment spend, like if they don't build bridges, it will lead to unemployment. So that's why people say that, should I invest there or invest here? I think there is no either-or question. They both are at different ends, and they are both coming actually closer. India wants more investment in fixed assets, and that's why it is coming towards this way. And China is actually spurring consumption growth, and it is also coming towards India. But at this point, you can own both. So that's the first point. And secondly, you cannot really buy a warrant which will give you an exposure to the economic growth. That, okay, this is a warrant for India, and this will grow by 15%. What you have to do is you have to invest in companies which can benefit from that growth. So it boils down to that. And you can find good companies in both economies. It's not an either-or question. So speaking of that, if you look at India's stock market, as I mentioned earlier, you have a lot of companies where you can invest and take advantage of the growth. And India's economy is propelled by a private sector. And even in stock market, you will find that 80% of the stocks are owned by private sector. So you can access the growth through stock market, which is more important than worrying about whether the economy is growing or not. So going back to my original thesis, I want to show some case studies which will show the kind of contradictions that occur in India. Things are growing but not adding value. Things are not growing but adding more value than you would have imagined. So one story which is sold to a lot of investors is infrastructure. This picture I took last year when I was in Mumbai, in the middle of jam. And normally, if I have 4 meetings in a day, that's like 4 hours of meeting, I will spend 6 hours in traffic, commuting between the... So this is a real story. And people who are on the road, they are all driving cars. Very few two-wheelers you will find. So these guys can really pay for better infrastructure. So that's not an issue. These guys can pay. There is demand. So you might think, investing in infrastructure companies is a great idea. So let me just give you an example of a leading infrastructure company. What happened to that company? By the way, I will use 2 terms very commonly during my presentation, which is top-down and bottom-up. What it means is top-down, when you look at a picture from a distance, what's your view? And when you do a deeper analysis, which is bottoms-up, and you really find an investable idea which can take advantage of the promised growth. So this is a leading infrastructure company. When I say leading, it's like really leading. I'm not being very selective about this company. They grew their sales 5 or 6 times in 5 years. I can't imagine that any company doing easily in US. And for the same reason, because there is need for infrastructure in India, people can pay. But look at what returns shareholders got. I mean, if you look at on the opportunity cost basis, shareholders have actually lost money. What went wrong? That's the question I'm trying to understand. So I analyzed the financials of this company. I found that whatever money they generated from operations, they invested 20 times that money back into the business. And how did they do that? They came to capital markets, raised debt, raised equity. So they diluted our shareholders. When you raise money from the shareholders, the number of shares increase and the price falls just because of dilution. On top of that, they raised a lot of debt. So when the interest rates go up, which is the case right now, their financing costs increase a lot, and then they started going in the red. But that is at the financials level. What was going on in the company? This company was too ambitious. They wanted to grow too fast, too soon, and they overbid for the projects which government had to offer. So when I say bidding, the government said, okay, I want to build a port. An airport, who will share the maximum revenue with me? And these guys said, okay, I will share the maximum revenue. They got the project. And they were unprofitable from the get-go. There was no way you could have made money on the... And over a longer period of time, whatever money you make is reflected in the stock price. I mean, investors may be naive in the beginning, but eventually they realize what this company is up to. The business they were in was moderately profitable. It was not like very profitable because they had to put in a lot of money in the first place. They made it unprofitable, and that's what happened. So when you look at investment ideas, top-down story looks good, but then you have to do bottom-up analysis whether the management is geared to take advantage of that growth. So let's take another example. This is a retail store, a shop, and this picture is taken by me. I went to visit a village in Maharashtra, and that's where I took this picture. And this gentleman is actually not an employee. He is the owner of this shop. And this is actually his house. If you can peep through, you'll find you can see his house from the back. So you and if you look at the 10 million outlets in India, a lot of them are on that angle. I mean, the home has become the shop. And there is no employee. They just, you know. So you might think, oh, organized retail, modern retail has a lot of potential. And it's true. The organized retail is only 5% of their total retail. When I say organized retail, I mean the malls and, you know, more efficient shopping, you know, malls. So look at the performance of this company. They grew their sales 8 times in 5 years, and look at the returns they generated. And this is the leading retailer. I'm not being picky about the company. I'm not picking the company. They actually got bankrupt. So this company didn't go bankrupt because it was leading, and it was able to raise money from gullible investors, and it survived. Now, what went wrong? If you look at the financials of this company, the last 5 years, they have lost money. And, of course, the management was very ambitious. So the management was ambitious, and the business per se was not profitable in the first place. Looked like a bad business. I mean, it's just what happened? I mean, what went wrong? So to explain that, let's go and understand the cost of doing business for this person. Now, he's the employee. He's the owner. He's not an employee. So he doesn't have to pay to anybody to run this shop. Since this is his own shop, his own house, he doesn't have to pay rent. He doesn't pay electricity also for various compliance reasons or very regulatory reasons. At the same time, I'm sure he doesn't pay even taxes. So his cost of operations is like bare minimum. Whatever he makes on selling something, it just goes to the bottom line. How can you compete with such a retailer? Very difficult. An organized retailer will have to buy land in a prime place. The rental costs are very high. If you look at the land per capita in India, it's one of the lowest. So you have to pay a lot of rent. And then you have to pay taxes. You can't steal taxes because you're a corporation. You can't hide, you know, in the crowd. And the amount of money you can make by, you know, circumventing the middleman is really not much because the end prices are still regulated. It's not that a milk which is available to me next door will be more expensive than the milk which I have to go and travel 2 miles. It will be the same price. So there is really no advantage for modern retail in broadly, but there are certain segments where they are successful. But in this segment, they have been very unsuccessful. Now, let's talk about the boring stories, which top-down look very boring, and I will explain why they are boring. But at the same time, they made money for shareholders. So this is a lube oil company. It's like you change oil and, you know, to your two-wheeler or four-wheeler, and everybody knows that it is a dying business. When I say dying, what I mean is that as technology advances, you need to use less and less oil. So there is no volume growth. The volume is actually shrinking in this business unless the number of vehicles, you know, dramatically increase. So that is one comfort India has, that the number of cars on the road are less. So over time, you will have more vehicles. But this is also, but the volume consumption is going down. But look at what this company has, you know, demonstrated. They grew their sales by 100% in 5 years. It's like doubling in 5 years. Trust me, it's like growing at that rate is like a sin in India. People don't even consider you a growth stock. And it's not. But look at the returns they generated. 600-700%. How did they do that? So let's go a little deeper and let's not shy away from the boring stories. So this company has a very good brand. So they have a good pricing power. If they charge a little higher, people are ready to pay. They have a reasonably good distribution, like about 100,000 outlets. Not bad. If they have 1 million or 2 million, it's pretty good. But this is also not bad. And on top of that, whenever the technology advances, they come up with a better product, which is cheaper per volume, but it also saves them oil. So they are able to price it such that both the consumer benefits as well as they benefit. And at the same time, they don't have to invest in building capacity because existing capacity is more than enough for taking care of the volume growth because that's not going to happen. So as a result, this company has been able to generate a lot of profits and they have been very good with shareholders. They pay very good dividends. So as a result, they have been rewarded. And I still don't think that the stock has, you know, growing beyond their fundamentals. It might have become expensive, but not like the other stocks had become. Another boring story, two-wheeler industry. I'm sure you don't see a lot of two-wheelers in U.S. So that's the future of two-wheelers. In India, when people have money, they will switch to cars. It's a different matter. Many people have been driving two-wheelers for 30, 40 years. They don't even change. So it's also not a very growth-oriented industry. It has grown a little over 100%, another sin in India. But returns they have generated for the stock market, for the shareholders, have been reasonably good, more than twice that of the index. And how were they able to do it? They also have a good brand. So people are able to pay a little bit higher than the local brands. And on top of that, their power over their supplier is immense. So they ask their suppliers, okay, give me on credit. I will give your money back in a month or two. And then they sell on cash. Because nobody gives you credit to buy a two-wheeler. You sell on cash. So they make money even before selling the two-wheeler. And on top of that, they make, you know, the margins, whatever margins. And they have been doing this well for like so many years. That's how they made money for shareholders. They don't have to grow. They just have to grow profitably. So the reason I'm sharing you all these stories is because people just chase growth and say, oh, India is growing at 7%. China is growing at 9%. Let's go for China. You can't invest in an economy. You have to invest in securities. And that's where you have to be very bottoms up and very stock specific. What makes money, what doesn't. You can find, by the way, you can make money even sitting in US if you can find the right stocks. You don't have to chase, Asia or frontier markets. So, but it's a different matter that you can find those companies more in number there. But that doesn't mean you can't make money. You need only one good stock to make money. Honestly, I mean, if you know that this is going to go 10 times, you don't need to invest in 100 stocks. So that was about, you know, how I see growth. Finally, what kind of time horizon is important? The reason I'm asking is because in Matthews, we did an internal study. We looked at the five-year rolling returns, and I shared it with one of your members. And we found that if you hold it for 5 years, in the last 20 years, your chances of losing money by investing in index in India is only 15%, based on historical data points. But if you held it for 1 year only, your chances of losing money is 30%, because you can't time the market. And I think in 2009, the biggest gain came on one single day. That was the majority of the returns. On one single day, the 2009 returns. And that happened because a particular government got elected and people were very excited. whatever be the reason. But you can't time those days. I couldn't time it. I study this market every day. I can't do it. I can't expect anybody to do that. So the key is to remain invested and to be patient. And I will give you some anecdotes. So on the top left-hand chart, you see the returns which different indices have, you know, generated during different time periods. The first time period is when the tech bubble burst. MSCI US index declined by a little over 20%. And look at what happened to India. It declined by 40%. Which tech companies were there in India? Why did the tech bubble had to impact India? But it did impact. And look at the global financial crisis. US corrected by 40%. India corrected by 60%. You can't, people might sell you that, okay, you can diversify by investing in India, but that diversification is not true in the short run. You might lose more money there, in fact, if you just worry about short term. And that's why I tell you, don't be short term invested in investors in India. If you had been a long term investor, this is 10 year returns, then you see that, yeah, then it starts decoupling, if you, so to speak, but not in the short run. So that's all, and I would just re-emphasize the key ideas. You can't really think top-down when you invest. You have to be bottoms-up. You have to be specific to the stock. And you can't use India or any one country for short-term diversification. You have to be long-term investors. Questions?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing investing in India today with Sunil Asnani, a portfolio manager with Matthews International Capital Management. And again, I'm Jennifer Schatz, Senior Vice President of Marketing for Matthews. So now we'd like to open it up for questions. So I think, do we have to move this over?
Please ask easy questions.
Question. I understand that India's inflation rate is like 8%, very high, and the government obviously has to slow down the inflation rate. And how do you expect them to do that? And what will do the economy and any investment I might have in Indian stocks?
Okay, so if I understand the question correctly, inflation is high, what the government can do and what will be the impact on the economy of inflation, or what the government will do? The impact on economy, right?
And investing in the Indian stocks.
Yeah, so impact on the stocks by the inflation, or impact due to
slowing the economy, which means you're going to slow consumption, I would think.
Yeah.
And earnings are going to drop.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, sure. Let me handle it one by one. So the inflation that you hear is 8%. But the inflation that is reported is not the real inflation. The actual inflation is much higher. I don't know why they do this, but they think wholesale price index is the real inflation. I simply do a other way of, you know, calculating the inflation. I look at the nominal growth and I look at the real growth and I see the difference, you know, what's the difference. Because that, I think, is a better estimate of inflation. From what I recollect, it was almost 12%. But I can check. But it was definitely higher than 8%. So inflation is high, and that's a fact. And what the government is – and let me – before, you know, going into what government is doing, let's decompose inflation and see what can the government do for different – pieces of inflation. One piece is food inflation. Right? Now, why food inflation is occurring? Many reasons. One reason is that India's food grain productivity is very low. It is like one-third that of China and one-fifth that of United States. Why is it that? One reason is Indians have not invested in, you know, productivity. That's the obvious answer. Land reforms haven't been done. Another obvious answer. Third is they have not invested in the logistics. You'll be surprised. One third of the fruits and vegetables gets lost in India because they don't reach the warehouse or they're not protected from perishing. And very few of the fruits and vegetables are actually processed. So food inflation is a supply side issue. And what can India do about it is to invest in food grain productivity. For that, they have to open up the agriculture. They have their political agenda and political difficulties in, implementing it. The agriculture lobby is very strong, and they feel that they are doing a service to the farmers by not opening up. But whatever be the reason, it's a supply-side issue. The second component of inflation is manufacturing-led. So what it means is that the manufacturers are the cost of operating, and that's so high that the end consumer feels the pinch. And if you look at 70s and 80s, this inflation was really very high because there was very few people got the license to actually make anything, and they will take full advantage of that by marking up the prices. But since 91, this inflation has come down. And why is that? Because the government opened up and led to more competition, more growth. But at the same time, people were forced to, charge reasonable prices. That inflation has been in control for the last 10 years. That has come down. The third piece of inflation is because of fuel prices. India actually doesn't have a lot of control on it. But the least they can do is to not subsidize the prices that consumers end up, paying. What is happening is end consumer is very happy. The prices go up here. They still pay the same price. They don't adjust the demand once the prices go up. But this is changing now. And I think for good or bad reasons, the government has realized that they can't subsidize it forever. Their deficits are, affecting the economy one way or the other. And as a result, they have started passing on the prices, and I think the demand will correct based on that. And if the whole world does it, then oil prices probably might correct. And even if they don't correct, even if they stay where they are, they will impact India less and less over time, because India's wallet will increase, and the impact of oil on India's wallet will be lower and lower. But as of now, people are paying like one third of their salary in, paying their two-wheeler bills. But this will change, I think. These are the three main components of inflation. I didn't know if I answered your question, but the government, if at all they can do anything, it's on the supply side of food. And they can keep opening up the sector, make it more competitive. That's all they can do. And monetary policy will have some impact on, the economy. It will impact more the companies which are interest rate sensitive. For example, automobiles. Now, in cars, specifically in India, 70% of the cars are bought on credit. So if you get the credit at very high terms, you will not buy the car. And the commodity prices are high, so the seller doesn't have a lot of cushion to actually pass on the prices. The consumers are not buying, and you have to actually raise prices. So that impacts those interest rate sensitive companies. But the stocks or the sectors which have been less affected in this area have been those with pricing power, like staples, because people will smoke no matter what. So, and even if the taxation is high, those companies are able to pass on the price rise. But I can understand this cannot go on forever. I mean, if all countries raise their rates, the demand contraction will happen, and the commodity prices will come down, and then a part of the problem will be solved. But the long-term way of solving inflation in India is to invest in infrastructure, to invest in agriculture productivity. That's almost one-third of the inflation. If you can control that, that can help a lot of issues. And look at the fruits and vegetables. If you are able to, control the wastage, imagine the production will just go up by 30%. and you don't have to invest in productivity. Whatever, just, you know, save perishing, and you will see inflation will come in control. And other thing I was mentioning him was that the prices in one part of the country may be 20 times the prices in another part because of lack of logistics. So if you invest in logistics, that inefficiency will also come down. So I wouldn't try to paint a rosy picture. If you look at the inflation, it has always been there. If you look at the last 40 years, 6 to 8% reported inflation was always there. And India still did manage to grow. Did I answer all your questions or anything I left? Ladies first.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple questions. One is, since there's such this underground economy with people selling, you know, how do you accurately measure anything? And then the second question is, can you speak to the real estate market and the, you know, the timing of that right now? Because the way I feel is it's a great opportunity, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Sure. By the way, both are related, underground economy and real estate. A lot of black money is actually invested in real estate because many of the other avenues are being closed. You know, like the central bank is coming up with know your client norms. And believe it or not, central bank in India is quite independent. You may hear anything in the media, but they are more independent than many banks I've seen. And when they enforce know your client, it is done. So the avenues to invest black money is going down. And speaking of, your first question was on the measurement of, it's very difficult. In fact, I don't know. The real growth in India might be higher than what you see. That's just my speculation. Let me tell you one thing. The number of people who pay taxes in India is like 2%, right? So, what it means is that there is a lot of money which is lying, and the one big way people actually launder the money is through exporting. You know, they will under-invoice exports and over-invoice imports. And some people estimate that the black money, overseas black money, is almost $1 trillion. And India is the biggest contributor of that, you know, that black money. Yeah, so measurement is an issue, but I think if you start measuring, it will only go up, not go down. So if that is any comfort. And second thing is the real estate. So real estate is going to grow for sure, because if you look at the house ownership in India, it's pretty low. And as families become more nuclear, you know, you need more homes for the same, you know, family. Earlier they were living in tier two cities in a joint family environment. Now their kids are going to cities, urban cities like metros. They need homes for themselves. So top down story looks very good. But look at the available options. Many of the real estate companies, they have a lot of corporate governance issues. The way they make money is they will buy an agricultural land, and then they will use their political connections to classify that as a non-agricultural land. And the price rise in that change is almost 20 times. And that is all happening because the government thinks itself too smart. Okay, I can regulate, I can micromanage. So they are not able to do. They make very little money in actually constructing the house and selling it. I mean, they should make money there, but that's not what is happening. So as a result, their interest is more to acquire land and convert, and through any means, and then convert it into non-commercial. And the actual house ownership may still remain where it is. They will make their money. So the way is not through developers. I mean, if you look at the accounting norms these developers currently follow, pathetic. I mean, if you look at their financials, there is a thing called percentage of revenue recognition. What it means is that if you start a project, if it is half finished, you can recognize half of revenues, even though nobody has bought it. There is no cash. But you can show your financials very good. Many developers follow that, you know, principle. Market is smart, eventually. And so development, investing in developers is probably not the best way. Maybe there are some honest developers, but you have to really look hard. The way to go about is go through housing finance companies, which are actually a credit company. But as more house ownership increases, the mortgages will also increase. And mortgages in India is not based on credit score. So they will give it only when you have the you can show them that you are working and you have a very good salary. So not everybody gets that credit, but whoever gets it is actually able to repay, and very few defaults in that area. So as a result, I would say they make more money, but those stocks are also not cheap because people know that this is probably the only way to invest. So I don't know if I have answered your question. You have to look for the right valuation. But yeah, if housing finance companies is one way. The other way is to do which is derived from houses, like paints. You know, when people buy houses, they paint their houses. And there are some branded paint companies which have shown very good resilience in their demand. So that is another way. So you cannot play on the developers directly, but you have to use it indirectly in the whole chain, which is growing along with the underlying demand. Did I answer your question? Okay.
Hi. What are the shortcomings of the Indian education system, and when will it be on par with the American or even the European system?
The problem of education system. The basic problem is it doesn't teach you how to learn. I think that is the basic problem. It teaches you something and then you forget the way to learn because you just cram your way into the college, into the schools. I can tell you from my personal experiences. As a kid, if I write something which is different from what the teacher has, you know, dictated, I will not get full score. So what will I do? I will just memorize it the way it has been, and there is no need to learn it. And I studied in an English medium school, but honestly, I didn't really think in English. And the books were really, much ahead of my level. So I had no option but to memorize it, all the answers. The only saving grace was math, where if you're wrong, you're wrong. But otherwise, I mean, the system is needs a lot of improvement. And the other thing is education, the teaching as a profession in India is still not the best. People don't go there. Let's put it this way. People who go there are people who are not good students. So what happens is that I remember the same teacher will take extra classes for like 95% of the class. Now, if you are taking extra classes for 95% of the class, that means you are not doing your job during the daytime. And students are also compelled because they worry about grades and they don't worry about learning. So if they don't get the good grade, then they won't get admission, you know, different places. So there are a lot of issues with our education system. And other problem is that we have not invested in primary education, like basics. India invested a lot in higher education. That's why you see many software engineers in India. But if you go to the villages, people can't even write their names. And when we say that India is 60% literacy, it doesn't mean 60% people are educated. It means 60% people can write their name. So investment in education has not been done. Investment in teaching methods has not been done. It's an issue, and eventually we will have to, you know, we'll have to suffer unless we invest in that sector. Did I answer your question? Okay.
What could go wrong with investing in India?
So it depends on your time horizon. If you are investing for 1 year, anything can go wrong. But if you are investing for a longer period, say 5 years, then many of these factors which are short-term, they might get reversed. But then there is a volatility. If you can live with that volatility and have a longer time horizon, you will probably be fine. And when you asked what can go wrong with India, you meant from the investment perspective or you from the economy, for the country perspective? For the country perspective. So if you look at the India's oil consumption, 75% of the oil that India needs is imported. So if the oil price doubles, I think if oil goes up by $10, India's GDP growth will go down by 30 basis points, if that's a rule of thumb. So if it is $100 now and goes to $200, so that means the growth rate will come down by 3%. So instead of growing by 8%, it will grow by 5%. Right? So that is one way to look at it. Other thing is inflation, as I mentioned, if it is not controlled, the purchasing power of people will be eroded. We say India's middle class is very big, but if you go deeper into the numbers, they are like just above the poverty line, like very skewed towards poverty line. And how does India define poverty line? People who do not have 2,000 calories, that is poverty. So the person I showed to you on motorcycle, he is a middle class, not a poor person. If the inflation goes out of control, then it is going to affect the purchasing power of people. The third factor which is on top of my mind is the fiscal deficit. So Indian government, they collect less taxes and spend more. And you might say, oh, they should spend less. You know, that's a simple solution. But that will not happen for political reasons, A. And also, they don't actually spend a lot. I mean, if you compare it with China, they spend less as a percentage of GDP. But their problem is collection of taxes. They don't collect enough taxes. So what they need to do is to collect more taxes, and then they don't have to, you know, compete with private sector for the limited savings, you know, that the country generates for investment. And then that money can go to build bridges and roads and set up factories. So if the government can collect more taxes, that can help. And I think they have taken some measures to do so, but it will not be an overnight change. It will take a few years at least. Did I answer your question? I mean, the political problem is really not a problem for, I mean, honestly speaking, government X or Y, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. If you look at the contribution of government, it's 20% of GDP. And most government which come into power, the most parties, they generally continue with the reform process. But I think the least those governments can do is to let people, you know, trade, let people invest. They can just set people free. For example, the land, acquiring land is still an issue. And people think they are overpaying for the land. I don't think so. For example, I was talking to one major aluminium making company. They had come to our offices. And they were saying, oh, land acquisition is a big problem. I said, why? He said, you know, it affects our profitability. Then I, you know, grilled him a little bit and I asked him, okay, whatever land you are acquiring, suppose you end up paying 100 times that amount, 100 times, right? How much your project cost will go up? We calculated it went up by 5%. Now, if the project cost goes up, so if you pay a fair price to the landowners, your project cost goes up only by 5%. And if you delay the project by 1 year, you end up paying 10% tax, 10% interest. So it's better to pay them their right due and acquire land. All you need is right policy. I mean, we can, whatever land we have, you can manage with that. You need a right framework to acquire the inputs, the natural resources. Same issue with mining. I mean, India has a lot of resources, but the corporates are not ready to pay the rightful due to the landowners. They are not ready to afforest, you know, whatever deforestation they have caused. So I don't think it is a terrible thing. I mean, it's, these are solvable problems. India has enough resources. All we need is the right policy framework and some political will.
Hi. Could you talk to your most successful investing idea to date in India and also your worst?
I won't name them, okay? But I will tell you, one of them was a boring story, which I featured. And another of them was a real estate developer. So, did I answer your question?
Those are the best.
No, those best and the worst.
Can you give a little more detail, like why did you invest in a real estate developer and what went wrong?
Well, we try to, we think of, investors think that they are gods, you know, sometimes they have this feeling. But we end up realizing that we are not, we are also humans. And in this particular, the boring story happened because we looked at, you know, bottoms up. We have a bottoms up process. So we end up realizing that, okay, this stock over long term can do well, maybe not in 1 year. And we ended up investing. The second stock was probably the lesser of the evils among the developers. We thought that they are relatively more honest. I mean, if this is what is available, right? I mean, we are an India-dedicated strategy. We can't, you know, stop investing if we find, if we becoming pure, very puritanical, then we can't invest in more than five stocks. Because I know that even the best companies, they mend rules somewhere. I mean, even though I don't, may not have the evidence, but this is the way things work. So if I wait for things to become perfect, then the stock might, you know, price that in, and there may be no value in it. We have to invest in things which are imperfect, but moving towards perfection. Only then you can create value. So as part of that, investing in that real estate stock was, you know, was a, and we realized over time, we may not have lost a lot of money, but we, it was not the best idea, if that's your answer.
I was wondering, you have like China, and you got India, and you got Brazil. Those are the three fastest growing economies. How do they compare on the P basis or cash basis or growth for the companies? And why should I be investing in India rather than China or Brazil?
I don't know a lot of about Brazil. I've never been there, but from what I understand, their primary, you know, it's a commodity-led country, right? So sugar comes to my mind, and not only sugar, but iron ore. Many of the commodity natural resource companies are from Brazil. So if the iron ore prices go half, the income of that country goes down significantly. So you can expect that kind of volatility in the earnings, not only the companies, but also the people. So, but if you are a long-term investor, and if you can find a company which is master of its own destiny, so to speak, which will, you know, and then that might, you can find good ideas. You can't invest in Brazil. That I will go back to the same point. You have to invest in a Brazilian company, right? So, so you should look for good companies in each of these countries, and I'm sure you can find, any country, you can find good companies. Speaking of China and India, as I mentioned, it's not an either-or question. You can find good companies in both areas, and they have their own, both have their own issues. And if they had no issues, then probably won't make any money because, you know, the market will realize that. As far as P by E is concerned, I think India, I remember India more than anything else. It's about 16 and a half times, and if you compare it to their five-year average, it is lower than that. But if you look at their 10-year average, it's about that level. So it's very hard for me to say that India is cheap or expensive. It's very hard for me to make that judgment. But I can make that judgment easily, but relatively easily at a company level. It's easy for me to say, given the prospects for this company and the money it is making, it is cheaper or, again, it's a probability issue. I mean, I'm not 100% sure whether it is relatively cheaper or relatively expensive. And I think that is the way to invest. If you are investing in an index, maybe you have to look at the historical low P by E. But I don't think P by E is the right way to judge companies. If you are generating no cash, then any P by E is high for you. And if you're generating a lot of cash, then even a higher P by E might, you know, still put you in a fair bucket. I don't know if I answered your question. Okay.
Okay. We'll have to make that our last question. I want to thank Sunil for a great presentation and thank everyone here for joining us, as well as the audience listening on the radio. And now this concludes our program of the Commonwealth Club of California.